You're listening to CITR's UBC 100 Doc Series. We are broadcasting from the ancestral unceded territory of the Hukkaminam-speaking Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. In the last year, CITR has been digitizing our collection of reel-to-reel tapes and cassettes. These contain an archive of audio broadcast on UBC's campus and community radio station between 1949 and the late 90s. With help from UBC University Archives and the UBC Library Digitization Center, over 400 audio files are now available for the public to hear and download. In order to share this history, we have made a series of documentaries produced by students and community broadcasters. This project is funded by UBC's Centennial Initiatives Fund, celebrating a century of success at UBC. Tune in every Friday at 9 a.m. for the next 6 weeks, from May 20th to June 24th, for a new documentary. And visit our website, citr.ca, for podcasts and more information.
Hello, my name is Jay Peachy, and you're listening to the UBC Sasquatch Myth, a documentary produced for CITR's An Audio Evolution of UBC project. There exists the story of the Sasquatch who roamed the Musqueam territory, and specifically in the area now commonly known as UBC Endowment Lands. This documentary explores the story of the Sasquatch from a Musqueam perspective, and in this story we ask the question, are indigenous peoples in the modern westernized landscape merely a myth? Similarly, if a tree falls in the forest and no one sees it fall, is the story of its fall less unreal? When producing this documentary, we were asked to explore the archive of the CITR archive. And in doing that, I found there was no to little indigenous content on the radio. And given that UBC resides on Musqueam territory, I found it very odd, but also consistent with the history of the cultural domination. Joining me in this documentary is Ian Siegel and his daughter Audrey Siegel. Audrey is an activist and is known for her singing and drumming and supporting different grassroots movements as they relate to environmental and social issues. Her drumming and her words, as well as her father's storytelling, are key to this documentary.
Test, 1, 2, test.
We are going to be destroyed by this blast, and I think it's really a waste to destroy the environment that humans must survive in.
What about the other possible effects that it might have?
I think the largest effect is mainly the
CITR Sports. I'm Barry Greenfeld. In hockey, the Canucks lost 6-0 to the Detroit Red Wings. The Kings beat the Flames.
So the way that old Grandpa Steve would always like to tell that one was to tell out when the Sasquatch people or tribes, because they were kind of migratory. They'd come around following whenever things were coming ready for the harvest with fruits, herbs, different thing like that. As well as they liked many, so their diet was similar to the people's. But some of the Sasquatches, they would live, they would stay in one area. Other ones, mostly they're migratory. They'd move around where the food would go. And so the populations would change. Now, on the Musqueam, they lived up in the back in the endowment land by what was called a little lake there where the streams came through, right? And they'd always stay there. Every season, they always stayed there. And they got along with all the native peoples along the way, too. They had always harvested similar things, berries, roots, different things like this and that, and so then they'd shared the land, the uses of the land. And some of the older peoples actually could understand them, the language and the ways of the Sasquatches too, right? Because they were sort of like another part, like a race of people or something, but a little different, right? And so When they would come down in the different seasons, say when the salmon is running and the herring, ooligans, and I smelled them like that, and herring eggs, then they would come down about evening time when the natives were cooking and that, and the natives would share with the Sasquatches the seafood, mussels, clams, oyster, all the different fish, ooligan, smelt, and those.
We were in the kitchen of Ian Siegel in his humble East Vancouver home in the neighborhood of Strathcona. We're in his kitchen recording the interview. You can hear him rock back and forth on his chair as it squeaks. However, from time to time, he would pause and weep as a certain emotion would evoke, but he continues on to tell the story.
Also, too, was the custom of the natives in them days to dry fish, right? Sometimes with smoke, sometimes in the sun. And they were mighty partial to the dried fish, right? Dried fish and dried meats and this stuff. So they would give them, they would share with them. The people would share with the Sasquatches, right? And they would come, and it was a very pleasant arrangement, right? Time had gone by, and that's way before the, you know, this was in the older days, right, apparently. So then it had came through on one season that there wasn't so much abundance of the fish and the different things. And so then the Sasquatches had come there, and that, and then also too, besides just the food that they would share with them, they would also share with them the gift of fire in a little basket or a box, because they had become accustomed to the use of fire through the forest fires and this and that, and the eating of the things that, like that. But then they would, after a while, the fire would go out, now they don't got it. So they had an arrangement where the people would actually share fire in a little box or basket with these, with the Sasquatches. So they have it in their homes too, right, as such. But anyway, as it came down to it, the harvest of the nature was pretty trim on season or so. So then when they came, because they also, like, they shared with them cooked food also, so they seemed to have acquired the habit of cooked things, the meats and this and that. They're mighty favorable. So then they shared with them what they had, but the Sasquatches, there was quite a bit of them this time, of the migratory ones, and they were not happy. And they had complained, they were not happy, it was not so much like they would usually give them, right? But they took it and they went away, right? And then a little time later, the people woke up. The Sasquatches came in the night very silently and took all the supplies of the dried fish and ooligans and the, the mussels and the other shellfish that was stored in some of the canoes and the storage areas, and they had taken it, and they'd never done that before, never done such a thing like that. And so then the people were, when they saw this, they were very unhappy about it, and they had sent their representative to see them, right? You know, because like I say, amongst them, some of them were communicate with them and ask, go and tell them, you know, that because of what they have done there, they're no longer welcome, and they will no further share anything with them. No, and so don't come back. Anyway, so that's the story of the Sasquatch
feel calm, I always feel connected, I always feel peaceful when I get to be in the spaces that still have trees and nature. I feel more connected to the land and to the ancestors that are in this land and the energies that enliven this land.
We speak with Audrey Siegel in the space on the UBC Endowment Lands and where the Sasquatch once roamed. She was there as a young child with her relatives. She finds a space to connect with her ancestors there. In the background, you hear the noise from the UBC causeway that she calls a highway. In the interview, she feels an ancestral presence.
I have always felt, I guess you could say, a kinship to the Sasquatch, because my grandfather and uncle, since I was a baby, have told me stories and taken me to the places, have told me stories about the Sasquatch and taken me to the places that we shared paths and where their villages were. And they have shared the overlapping existence we've had on this land with the Sasquatch until this highway that we can hear so prevalently behind us, until this highway went in, the Sasquatch were here alongside of us. I think the word myth does denote a bit of reverence and respect as opposed to mocking and a heavy judgment as is often ascribed to First Nations spiritual beliefs. They say you'll see in books and in documentaries and lectures. Did you just? Okay. Wow. Okay. That. Something. People talk about First Nations beliefs. Well, they believe that. No, it's not that we believe that. We know it's true. We know that there are spirits in the earth, in the trees, in the land, in the air, in the water, in the birds, that there are spirits that we are far outnumbered by the other spirits and energies on this planet as human beings than most would believe or be comfortable to admit. So when we speak of myths, it shows more respect and a reverence and I think an appreciation. So I think of all the words used to describe First Nations, I have a book called First Nations Myths, and I thought, how offensive is that? Like, why is it a myth when people would be offended if we called Christianity a myth? And what Christians believe in, myths. I don't doubt a person, what a person believes and what a person tells me is their truth. I don't doubt that or question that. And I think that it shows privilege and entitlement, and the idea of superiority is clearly evidenced when we use words like myth a lot of the time.
Well, Sasquatch is not the word that we use. The tales that we have would have been, and similar, would have been the Zuniqua, the wild woman from the forest. Also, possibly, what we call a Bakwasa, the wild man from the forest.
We speak with Simon Winadzi James, a world-renowned storyteller, about the Sasquatch legend. His people come from the Kwakiwaka territory, which is a few hours north of Musqueam. However, we find there are connections between the mystical creatures in the woods.
Zunikwa was a very large creature, apparently with a horrible stench, that chased after children and ate them. The Pequus was another very stinky character that lived in the forest. But no one could ever track this creature because the way that it walked in a very evasive pattern. And this is why when you see the dances, they're done in that form where it's very evasive, the movements that it makes. It was seen often eating cockles, which was its supposed favorite food. And it was rumored that this creature could steal the spirits and souls of drowned people. So most of these things are based upon myth, but possibly from actually seeing a live creature. But I think one of my favorite stories was a true story, according to the elder that witnessed this. There was a potlatch up in Kinkum Village, where my adopted grandmother was from. And one of our elders left the big house, and as they were walking away, they actually saw a Sasquatch-looking creature sitting outside the big house enjoying the music. So they have rumored stories of these creatures actually existing. There's been sightings not just from today, but also my people from the past have these amazing stories about this very large, hairy creature that walked through the forest. And probably the basis of all of the myths of Zunikwa and Pequus and Yagis and all of these other creatures. Yagis is a sea monster, but a giant sea monster that looked similar to, I would say, the Zunikwa character, but emerged from the ocean. It could have been a Sasquatch swimming, for all I know. And I always seem to try to find where the real part came from in the myth. So that might be exactly where it comes from. It's just a swimming Sasquatch. Well, we've never really had any stories of one of these creatures attacking. Usually it was something like, again, stealing the souls of drowned people or eating children, which was kind of the boogeyman tale. We told our children, come home before it gets dark or Zunikwa will get you. It's the perfect boogeyman tale that can make sure your children are safe from the real dangers. If you're out in a forest at night, you get lost, you could be attacked by a bear or other wild creature. So it was a very easy way to get your children to come home on time. But there was no violent stories. I've never heard of any other than one time when some rocks were thrown at a big house, and you can hear the rocks hitting the roof. And they were apparently very big rocks. So this creature might have just been upset with something that had happened and expressed its frustration on the people by throwing rocks at the house. But I've never heard of a tale of a creature attacking my people. And if they did, I guess that person wouldn't have survived to tell the story. This is from the Kwakwaka'wakw stories that I've been told by my great-grandmother, my grandfather, and my father.
Thank you.
The drumming you've been hearing is a strong woman song performed by Audrey Siegel. It is originated from an Ojibwe woman who was confined in Kingston Penitentiary, a federal institution for women. Many indigenous women were incarcerated, abused, and some succumbed to suicide. The drum represents a heartbeat of the women, the strong women, and it appears throughout the documentary as a background. The beat, like a heartbeat of the woman, resonates throughout this documentary piece. Now we bring it back to Ian Siegel, who talks a little bit more about the Sasquatch and really what their daily living was on the Musqueam territory.
According to these guys, they had a similar, all the different peoples had a kind of similar arrangement with the Sasquatch, things. They shared, a lot of the natives were migratory to some degree, even though it was their territory, harvesting resource, and so they were similar too. And on some things they'd come to for the people to help them and that, and then like with the fire, when they didn't have the fire and they would wish for it at times and that, and then and sharing with them the different things that they wouldn't have been able to catch themselves, like elk and the deers and stuff that, once they had acquired the taste for eating like cooked food and had fire, right, within their culture, as such and that. And so it's...
They were formidable hunters. They were...
The Sasquatches?
Yeah.
Oh, sure, they would have been. They would have been, too. But for one reason or another, they liked the way that the... besides the sharing of the common salmonberry and blackberry. No, actually, blackberries weren't here then. Blackberries are an introduced species, so there wouldn't have been any blackberries. It would have been thimbleberries and the other diverse things like that, and then roots and other sorts of things like that.
More than anything, I feel grateful that I had time with my family to come here to learn the history, to learn what our experiences were on this land up till this highway went in at the creation of UBC. I am grateful that I didn't just get to spend the time learning these stories, these oral histories more accurately, but I'm grateful that I got to spend the time with my grandparents and my uncles, because again, it's a difference between then and now, and this was in the late 70s up to the mid 80s. The difference between then and now is so few families get to spend time together like that. Just say, okay, let's go for the afternoon, we're gonna go for a walk, pack a little lunch and put on some good shoes and bring a coat and we're gonna go, we're gonna show you something. And the idea that the Sasquatch is a myth, it's much the same as the Musqueam people. A lot of people are surprised to find that we, the First Nations of this land, whose land everybody here is occupying. Most people don't even know that we exist. Most people don't know that there is a reserve here, and that we, the people whose ancestors, their homes and businesses and roads and stores and parks are built on, that we are still here. So I relate to the Sasquatch in that way, that we are often thought of as a myth as well. And in fact, we are real and we do exist, as do the Sasquatch.
Yeah.
I was just a little toddler when I used to come here first with my grandfather, my uncle Blackie, and my uncles Marvin and Roy. But usually it was my grandpa, my uncle Blackie. We would walk from the reserve along this side, the water side of the highway leading to UBC, and we would go through through the trees sometimes and back out on the grass. And there wasn't as much traffic. There definitely weren't as many buses. So the sound of our own footfall, the sound of the birds, the sound of just the noises of the of what remains of this second or third growth forest, that's what we heard. And it was stories, and it was my grandfather humming, and it was conversations between my grandfather and my uncles, and it was me singing and talking along with them. It was a fun adventure.
The ones that generally lived there year-round and were not migratory, not to that extent, it was not them, it was the migratory ones that would come in, and the younger ones, and that, and then with the bigger group and everything, and being so big and powerful and stuff along the way, then, you know, then they could well have, it's like people sometimes, you know, they get a bad attitude. You get some people, you know, big muscle guys, and, oh, now you've got a bad attitude, you know. You're gonna, you know what I mean? Because you can see it, eh, in that respect. And especially in some of the younger people, if they're too full, if they're so impressed with their, but also, too, with the lack of food, and starvation aspect too, there is some necessity situation of it. There's always the stimuli response. I mean, you know, it hadn't happened before, but it hadn't, you know, the dynamics of that hadn't occurred previously, you know. So then, and then as they did well, then the relationships changed, right? Yeah.
Well, Musqueam and the settlement there and the trade are the dominant culture.
Yes.
You know, at the time as the...
Oh, yeah, because the community in those days, would have been much bigger than what it is now with, you know, as a traditional community, eh? You know, I mean, even, say, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, of course it would have appeared different, but the extent of it would have been, you know, quite considerable. You know, of land that they were cultivating and using for this and that and the other, and that, because you're looking at the with the middens that some of the stuff coming out of there that's goes back what 10,000, 5,000, 12, maybe up to not maybe 14 back, not 20, but 14. I'm looking at the type of flints and the various other things, which of course are from all over the different diverse areas, different types of flints and different patterns and whatnot of the various implements of the day, as that was sort of their early knives, right? Mm-hmm. For, you know, like utilitarian purpose, right?
Yeah. So the Sasquatch, they were using those implements?
No.
Okay, so they were really by hand?
Everything. They never had that.
Okay, so they never had that. Utilized technology.
No,
fire was a technology, or mystical technology to them?
Oh, definitely, okay. Definitely. Very mysterious. But it was a gift from the divinities to them, because the forest fire provided.
Right. So
and then they noticed, oh, wow, that meat's a whole lot better, tastes more savory, different when it was cooked up, right? And that, eh? And then also with the natives sharing with them cooked food, you know, mussels and the various things. And so
it's like a temptation. It's almost like an indulgence for them.
And so then I think they got used to it over the time, and then thought, well, you know, that's nice, you know. That's why they wanted the fire then. So, you know, boil it then, because there was so much abundance of these things, especially, you know, the shellfish and the other things that they themselves could gather, right? And the mussels and stuff and clams and everything, as they watch and that. But they didn't do that so very much. The mussels they would gather, but I don't think so much. They liked all seafood, right? and then big meat eaters and all of that, and then and in the same area where they lived is an area where the Musqueam peoples would gather up herbs for the herbal medicine, the most powerful herbs that they had for their health and medicine and for spiritual matters. They would gather up over in those areas, right? And that, and so, but the Sasquatch didn't gather them. They had no use for that.
So the stories of the Sasquatch like came to you every time as you were doing your taxi runs and
those and many others. Yeah. Other stories, just like, you know, they had so many, and then stories about things that happened here and there when the people were living here and there, but stories that were later dated, you know, from once the Europeans were here, eh?
Pre-14th century.
Like on some of the stories, like that they like to tell about the, like on the Musqueam, they used to have a spring, right, that the water came from, and they got all their drinking water from it, and it was in between, a couple of properties there, and then everybody had that water. And that for a long time, you know, well, hundreds of years. And then one of the people came and claimed well, blocked it up. And it sits there to this day, blocked up, that good spring water, right? And other people there on the reserve know about it too, but we don't care. But they know that whole story about
that. They don't want to bring that story up.
They don't like it if I bring it up. Yeah. They don't want to hear it. But yet, the only reason I brought up this whole story was because it would be useful to have that spring opened and that artesian water back for the drinking. It'd be much better for people than this water in the taps.
Who do you think blocked it?
Well, everybody knows who blocked it. I don't want to say no names.
Throughout Audrey's reconnection with her culture, ancestral messages have been revealed to her, and we ask her in the space where the Sasquatch roam, in amongst the bypassing traffic, what messages does she feel at that time and place?
Well, the messages I get, the information I get from the ancestors is that they are happy that we, the Musqueamach Musteyuch, exist, that the other First Nations that existed nearby alongside our villages and territories still exist. But there is also an overwhelming feeling of fear. There is an overwhelming feeling of frustration. There is an overwhelming feeling of even anger at times that so much has been destroyed, so much of what truly is sacred, not just to First Nations, but to all life, has been destroyed in the name of progress. And when I speak of progress, I speak of progress in the sense of how it is prescribed to us by the corporations, especially the Corporation of Canada, especially the mayor and his council here of Vancouver, who, though they do some good work to help make the city less, they say it's to make it more green, but it's really to do less damage. It's not really about making it more green, but there is some good work being done on the part of the city to lessen some of the damage being done and the impact on the nature that still exists. But for the most part, all of the resources, all of the land are being completely depleted and sold out. And the ancestors who lived here and thrived here for well over 10,000 years, they had ways of being and systems of existing that enabled us to thrive. We didn't have depleted. We didn't have extinct. We had fires. We even had controlled fires. We had trading. We had commerce. We had a language that was created all across Turtle Island by First Nations in order to accommodate that commerce. How did we here in the Musqueam territory have the shells? What? I can't remember the name of them right now. The shells that a lot of people wear abalone on their head. Abalone. How did we here in Musqueam have abalone when they aren't naturally occurring in our waters? We traded from the north, we traded from the south, and we had our own laws, we had our own ways of governing ourselves, we had our own ways of working out personal disputes and violations that happened within our communities that were hyper effective, or we wouldn't have thrived for over 10,000 years and 16,000 years, as some new evidence is dating us to. So when I am in this space, I feel a joy and I feel a peace and I feel a connection that I don't feel when I'm out there in the concrete jungle. But I also feel a level of frustration and sadness. Sometimes my heart hurts when I think of what my people have lost, and more accurately, what was taken, and what continues to be taken, and what our own people sell out from underneath us. It's a reminder that we need to move back to what is sacred and putting a value on life instead of only valuing dollars. And we look at why did the Sasquatch leave? They left because this highway went in and it disrupted the way of life to such an extreme that they couldn't exist here anymore. Because for the time before contact here, we lived alongside of Sasquatch and many other, we'll say, quote-unquote, mythical beings. And it really was just the way it was. And then other people came along from other lands and other cultures, and they started to see these things, and they weren't sure what to make of it. So they were fascinated and wanted to know what it was. But in essence, they started hunting them. They tracked them down. They terrorized them. They needed documentation and footage. You see people making documentaries still about Sasquatch, Yeti, the abominable snowman. And I understand the fascination, but there comes a point where we need to just leave things be. We were let be here for over 10,000 years, and look at what's happened in the last 200 years to our sacred land, to our people. We have astronomical rates of addiction and suicide. We have astronomical incidences of pedophilia, rape, and violence within our own communities as well as outside of our communities. There is no safe place to be an Indigenous woman on Turtle Island. There is no safe place to be an Indigenous child on Turtle Island. Why are we having to reoccupy our own lands? Why are we having to reoccupy government offices? Why are we having to occupy our own band offices? And all of that is directly connected to the spot where we're at, because it's idealistic for me to say this, but I'm going to say it. If things had been done in a good way, when this land was still raw and wild and allowed to do what the land and all the lives on it needed to do, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in now. And now we're trying to play catch up and stop the devastation, as well as open minds and hearts to awaken people that we're not saying this just because we're First Nations. We're saying this because we have a history and a connection to this land that gives us some more foresight, forethought and insight into what is needed and how to not just slow down this train, but to stop it and turn the situation around so that that balance and justice can be achieved for all again, including the Sasquatch, who to most people it really is just a mythical creature again, just like the Musqueam people.
It's crazy, you know, the few, less than 1%, destroying the whole place, you know. Why would they want to do that? I mean, eh?
It's a little of the, this rogue Sasquatch parallel, you know, if you want to go back pre-technology.
You know, it's all preordained. You know, in the prophecies from the Delphi Oracle and the ancient things, to watch for these bad behaviors. And so, but the Earth itself, being a living spiritual being, and the rest of the things here, and similarly so, they won't allow it to come to that. Man will be go back to another form, and that, and then, because I'm looking at periods of time, of long time.
Thousands of years.
To me, 1,000 years is like a day, for the way I look at time, right? It's and that, and so I'm looking at, back to the beginning of this place, and that, as such, and to the earliest of the inhabitants and the dwellers that have came to live here and to help develop it and this and that. And so I have no doubt that it will still be a shining blue planet, but it has to, you know, man can, he can do better. He can change and that, but the dynamics is just too many people doing too much, and it just, arithmetic don't work. It just doesn't work. It's like, we are like a pestilence on the face of this place.
Can the electricity change? Do you think, because you're talking about electricity, we are just...
Yeah, the capacity of electricity will change. All the electrical things.
In human electricity, can it...
The human electricity.
Can it change so that these behaviors find some form of self-correction?
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely, definitely. Because the adaption towards we could say the evolutionary adaption will correct the imperfections. And even with these genetic people, that they're going to grow like they're growing cows and sheep and pigs from one little cell, and they grow it up, and now people growing it from a cell, a human being. God, that's crazy.
Well, it's in movies.
It's sacrilegious. It's forbidden, eh? Yeah. And that, eh? But also, too, this isn't the first time. This has happened before.
So, let me put this word. The word that the greenest city is a myth.
Yes.
And also the parallels between the predatory hunt of the mythical creature by modern camera equipment, or this hunt, and paralleling that to the indigenous women and their existence. Mm-hmm. Does that resonate with you, those two words, a myth and the predatory hunt?
Of course. Even here in my Musqueam community, the tiny postage stamp size piece of land, we have been, we are told we should be grateful to have, compared to the incomparably larger territory, 40 villages at least, that our people roamed through for over 10,000 years seasonally. Myth and the predatory hunt. I have been called a princess. I have been called a squaw because of these myths that First Nations women are virtuous and, you know, porn stars at the same time, that we are easy and that we're dirty and that we are not human, and that, again, this spirituality that we are expected to have in us, and these understandings of knowing what does that wind mean, or look at this, like I'm trying to, that there are these ideas about who we are as First Nations women, that we are treated and expected to be extremes in many directions, when really what we are is the same as everybody else. We are human beings in a state of struggle and suffering, but we are also in a constant state of healing and working towards thriving again. And the predatory hunt, I've been hunted since I was 12. I've been hunted by men since I was 12. And even up till last summer on here down at the reserve, walking home from the bus stop at night in the dark, men come down the street in their vehicles, drunk men, stumbling around too, and follow our women around. One of them tried to grab me and pull me in a truck. Our security, our VPD liaison, they did nothing. A few community members told me they recognize the truck. They know that truck. They've seen it coming through the community. So it is much like the Highway of Tears in most of our communities. Most predators know where the good hunting grounds are and where the prey is readily and available. And that's what we are. We are prey for these hunters. And the misconception is that because of the TRC and because of the beginning of a inquiry into the murdered and missing women after 30 or 40 years of so many women pushing for it, that now because these two things have finally occurred, that we should be happy and we should be quiet. But the truth is that the TRC and the inquiry only serve a few. The healing that those few get, I would never deny them, and I support 100%. But the fact that so many are excluded from the process itself and so many are denied that justice and inclusion means that further damage is being done to those that aren't included, and I will never support that. What I also know is that our women are going missing and being murdered and being violated and traded and commodified every day. TRC and the inquiry haven't stopped the damage and the devastation that occurs to our women still. For over 500 years in this land, we have been nothing but a commodity and an inconvenience. I say, with knowing full well that it's the truth, that every dead Indian in this land of Turtle Island is still a victory for the government. Some people think that that's a really harsh statement, but what is truly harsh is that most people won't even look at that and see why I say it. Why do I say that? What is my experience? What have I witnessed around me? I'm not just going off statistics. I'm going off of what I have seen in my 43 years on this planet, what I have experienced, and how I have been treated, neglected, abused, ignored, violated, and how that continues. That when I go into city council to address an issue, unless I have booked my 5 minutes, unless I have my regalia on, a lot of the time I'm asked to leave the building. Because they know that they're not going to like what I say. When I speak of homelessness, when I speak of the mental health crisis, when I speak of the necessity of raising the rates and for welfare, when I speak of the necessity of dealing with the mental health crisis instead of just letting things get worse, when I speak of the reality of what this developer-driven market has done to my people of the downtown east side, they don't like it. So they find ways to make me leave the building. That colonial building is put up without the permission of my people on top of my ancestors, and then they tell me that it's private property and I'm not allowed to be on it. But people wonder why First Nations have anger, why we are reoccupying, why we are organizing ourselves and moving en masse to places like Kinder Morgan terminals with the support of so many settlers, self-identified settlers, and people who just genuinely love and care about this land. But the truth of the matter is that as a First Nations woman, I know what it's like to be hunted. I know what it's like to never feel safe. I know what it's like to never feel like my life matters at all. I know what it's like to feel like I am nothing but an inconvenience within my own community and outside of my community. And despite that, I still exist. Despite that, I won't stop speaking and I won't stop acting to move things back in the direction of where things need to be. And not just from my perspective, from the perspective of creating better days for all. What is good work? Good work is work that benefits all and comes at the expense of none. People tell me that that's idealistic and that's not possible. And I say, then stand back and watch me. Don't get in my way, because I will show you. I will show you that not only is that possible, but that it is going to happen. Wow, we have this movement starting. The life givers, we're leading the way. The matriarchs are rising. The women are uniting. The women are awakening. Idle No More first happened. Sylvia had that sign, when sleeping women wake, mountains move. Well, we're not just moving mountains, we're crumbling them. I issue a direct invitation to Trudeau. Meet with me. Talk with me. Listen to my experience in the land that you and your predecessors have created. Listen to the experience that I have had at the hands of you and your government. You want to talk to only the comprador class, the less than 1% of the elite, of the elected. You need to consult with all of us. You need representatives of all of the First Nations. And yes, that takes time, but that wouldn't even be necessary if things had been done in the right way. So don't put it on us that it's going to take time and it's going to cost money, because every penny made on this land that is stolen and occupied is First Nations money, is Indian money. It's not Canadian money. And this is the reality of where we are. And I will never be swayed from that, because I know that that's the truth. And when I stand here on this land, I feel more... I am more empowered when I am on the land, when my feet can be on this land where my ancestors have been for over 10,000 years. I have a privilege here on this land that other people don't, that I can feel that connection and I can draw on that power, and then I can find healing in that, because the end goal for me is healing, peace, justice, freedom for all. I don't want this government to continue its reign of tyranny and oppression, and I will do I will continue to do the work that I'm doing and speaking the truth that I'm speaking to put a stop to that.
You've been recently connecting into Haida Gwaii, and so the image that comes to mind for me is a culture that has and people has defended itself from, you know, the notion of Canada. It's had a large body of water to separate itself. It has its own governance system. And so there's a journey to get there. There's not a highway to Haida, so to speak. And so for me, knowing this is a bit of that portal and that feeling of how it can be here. And, you know, yeah, there's Haida warriors here that you connect with. So being in this space and then visualizing, you know, over there, and they have their own issues too, but... I assume you're looking for the, you know, the gems, so to speak, or those stories or those ways that can give you medicine here. What thoughts come in your mind when I kind of paint that picture?
The peace that I found in Haida Gwaii was completely unexpected. I have been, I think like a lot of people, enchanted and enamored with Haida Gwaii since I was six. At six, I decided that I would be in Haida Gwaii one day and I would sleep on that moss. When Greenpeace invited me to come and do the work for the kind of the connecting the dots journey of six different First Nations heading up from Vancouver to Haida Gwaii last summer, one of the big reasons I said yes was because I needed to see that moss. I needed to be on that land. I needed to be in those trees, and I had no idea why. And I think, again, like a lot of people who go up there, you don't want to leave. You know you will be back. You don't just go to Haida Gwaii once. My plan now, because of the healing and the connection that I have found to what is a way more intense and primal land, my plan now is to have a space there to be a good portion of the year to restore and to heal and to be still and to be quiet and to heal myself, to empower myself to be able to keep doing this other work that I do. But I am also aware that in Haida Gwaii, as there is in every other First Nations community, there is a horrific problem of protection of rapists and pedophiles, that they have devastating deforestation going on in territories of each of the clans. Well, let me correct that, that they have devastating deforestation going on in... Specifically, I know the clan that I was adopted into, the Slinglanis clan, that without permission of the people of the land, these trees are being taken. And We have huge battles to fight, no matter whether we're here in Vancouver, Haida Gwaii, whether we're in South America, whether we are standing alongside of the monks in Tibet and Laos and China. We have many battles to fight, and we have to be careful in which battles we choose to fight. We have to be effective, and we have to allow the people that are most suited and have the best strengths to fight that particular battle to step up and fight that battle. And we need to have a rotating front line. We look at the way the Roman military operated, hyper-effective, rolling front lines where people constantly moved up to the front so everybody got a break. It's sad that we have to look at that model, but if we want to preserve anything with a hope of being able to turn things around, we have to be warriors of light, love, and peace for this planet. We have to be warriors of light, love, and peace for the people who can't represent for themselves, for the four-leggeds and the two-leggeds and our finned brothers and sisters who are unable to defend themselves. Mount Polly, well over a year and a half ago, tailings pond spill. Nothing was done. That land is still toxic. Every salmon that comes through that water is now toxic, and they're all coming down here. Is there such a thing as a non-toxic salmon now? More and more, the moose are turning up in the Treaty 8 Northern Trappers Alliance area with huge cancerous, they're filled with cancerous ulcers inside their bodies. The buffalo had to be reintroduced. More and more, we are losing what made us, what allowed us to thrive, what connected us. We hear beautiful BC everywhere. It's promoted for tourism. Yet, tar sands now, I hear on the news every day, on especially on the business news, that we need to hurry up and get that infrastructure set up so the tar sands can get back to work because Canada's losing money. We're in a deficit. Come on now, everyone, just quit with this ridiculous BS about the nature and land. Progress, money. We gotta keep drilling. We gotta keep raping. We gotta keep violating. It's like a woman who has been beaten and raped to such a degree that she's no longer usable for that purpose, yet still being forced to serve that purpose. It's violent, it's graphic, and it hurts. And now we have the juxtaposition of that, of the warriors of the light, love, and peace saying, I'm not going to let you do that anymore. Enough is enough. Those that are unable to defend, protect, and speak for themselves, it is our job to do that in a way that represents them and honors them and the rights that they have and we have to stand up and say, no, we are not just the 99%. We come from literally places of light and love and peace that will move us all forward in a good way. And I will not allow the devastation and the destruction to continue.
This final interview is with Rocky LaRocque. He is from Stehalis, home of the Sasquatch people. They have high regard for the Sasquatch as a being, as a mythical and spiritual creature. We speak with Rocky as he creates some artwork at a community festival a number of years ago. It's an image of a Sasquatch kneeling by the water.
Winter, my brother was hunting up the Harrison Lake, and when he looked down at the lake, he noticed that he seen two dark objects down on the beach. So he pulled over, and he jumped out of his truck, and he grabbed his binoculars. And he looked down. What was that on the beach? And it was a Sasquatch with this little baby, this child. And he said that the Sasquatch was knelt down, and it got some water. It was giving its baby some water to have a drink. So that's what I'm doing here. This represents here is a Sasquatch with the Salish cedar hat on. And that's, we come from the Sasquatch people, the people of Chehalis. Sasquatch is our everything. He's our God. We feed him. We acknowledge him. We acknowledge him in the longhouse, in our spiritual ceremonies and our dances. And he's, to us, he's our everything. So everything that I make or create, it has something to do with the Sasquatch.
Hey,
Thank you to CITR for the support of this production and to the UBC Centennial Initiatives Fund. We'd like to thank the interviewees in our story, Ian Siegel, Audrey Siegel. Audrey Siegel also performed the Strong Woman song in the Ojibwe Indigenous drum song, as well as Simon Wenadzi James and Rocky LaRock for their stories.
You've been listening to CITR's UBC 100 Doc Series. We would like to thank the UBC Centennial Initiatives Fund, Peter Doolin, Emily Morgan, Shyla Seller, and Katie Harris for researching, digitizing, and cataloging our archived tape. Nardwar the Human Serviette for curating the collection. Thanks to Robert and Bronwyn at the UBC Library Digitization Center for partnering with us to digitize, launch, and host the audio collection. Irwin at the UBC University Archives. And to Madeline Taylor for organizing this project and supporting our documentary producers. For interviews with the producers, podcasts, and more information, visit our website, citr.ca.
Hey, Horace, give us three shots of your best bourbon. And have that Russian waiter I like bring it over.